Usually that assumes priesthood too, right?
Well, I don't know if they're
no,
rolled
there.
But
anybody
get the
Melchizedek
that's debatable too.
At age 11,
pardon?
Did you get the priesthood at age 11?
I assume he did. The only record I know of is that he was ordained an apostle, but I assumed he was. Usually you're given the Melchizedek priesthood before you get your endowment. And there was a tradition of, you know, sometimes if they felt a child was sick, of giving him all of these priesthood honors, you know, quickly. You know, so he would have them in the next life. And so it wasn't totally unheard of for a child to receive the endowment when it was young, or priesthood when it was young. Okay, so I'm just going to summarize this. You know, many 20th century Mormons view the present system of seniority in the Quorum of the Twelve, allowing the succession of the senior Quorum member, calculated by date of entrance into the Quorum, to the presidency of the Church, as having been in place since the beginning of the Church, or at least since Brigham Young's accession to the presidency. Certainly when Young became Church President, a pattern was established. The senior member of the Quorum of the Twelve became President and Prophet of the Church after the former President's death. However, the question of how this seniority was reckoned, which is crucial, did not reach its present resolution throughout all of the 19th century. It is very possible that John Willard's ordination and subsequent events linked to it are a key element that caused this development and final resolution and change. So now we can look at my handout here and look at these stages of development of the succession and different ideas about it that occurred. In 1835, the first apostles were called, and they were ranked purely by age. So we have this totally bizarre, novel idea of seniority by seniority, by age. And so notice we have Thomas Marsh, Patton, Brigham Young, Heber C. Kimball, Orson Hyde, so on and so on. Okay. A number of apostles died or left the church, and so by 1841 there were some replacements. And in an epistle in 1841, the 12 signed themselves with this seniority: Brigham Young, Kimball, Hyde, Pratt, so on, Wilford Richards, Wilford Woodruff, John Taylor, George A. Smith. And so here we have two groups. So the first group, you had age within that group, and then you had the second group, and you have age within that group. Okay, what is the oddity you might notice in this second group in seniority? Right. Okay. That was shifted later on. Okay. 1848, we still have the system of age within groups, and the last two apostles show date of ordination and entrance into the Quorum. Okay. And so there was some ambiguity about what caused seniority here. Was it entrance into the Quorum, or was it date of ordination, because it was happening at the same time? Okay. In 1854, there was a new wrinkle added by Brigham Young, and he called Jedediah Grant into the first presidency, who had never been called to be an apostle or member of the 12. So he ordained him an apostle, called him into the first presidency. He was never in the 12. And then in 1855, John Willard was ordained, also became a counselor, and Daniel Wells, 1857. 1860, George Q. Cannon was ordained and entered into the Quorum of the Twelve.
So what
yes?
happened on 1855 that had not happened previously?
John Willard Young was ordained an apostle. November 22nd, 1855.
He was already ordained an apostle.
No, that's when he was first ordained. That's
you referred to it earlier, but
I referred to it earlier.
Event.
It's the same event, same date. Okay, I just went back in time, and now I'm backtracking. Okay. Okay. So a very important thing happened in 1861, and as you see, And here we have this ambiguity between ordination and entrance into the quorum solved by Brigham Young. And so as we've seen, Woodruff was ranked before Taylor in apostolic seniority because Woodruff was older, even though Taylor had been ordained before him. When they called these apostles in groups, often they weren't. Some of them were not in town. So when they came in town, they were ordained. But they had their age within the group. Okay, so Woodruff had always been sustained before John Taylor. However, at the October 1861 General Conference, the clerk, Taylor, called out Woodruff's name before his own. President, quote, President Young directed the clerk, J.T. Long, to place Brother Taylor's name above Brother Woodruff's, as Elder Taylor was ordained 4 or 5 months before Elder Woodruff, end quote. President Young said the calling was made in accordance with the date of ordination. Okay, so what does that do to the status of John Willard Young? Brigham Young has made explicit seniority by date of ordination. It really makes it almost a certainty, you know, barring some extreme unseen accident, that John Willard Young would be presented at some time, doesn't it? Okay.
Date of ordination, not necessarily date of a member of the 12.
Date right. Of date of ordination to the apostleship. Okay, and so Brigham Young ordained 4 of his sons apostles secretly. Okay, but they still had seniority by those date of ordinations, and they kept records of those dates. Okay, 1864, this other ordination I told you about, he ordained 2 more of his sons. Okay, and then he ordained John Joseph F. Smith an apostle secretly, and we have a really good description of this in the Wilford Woodruff Diaries, so I'll read some of that. They did some temple ordinance, and Young began to take off his temple clothes. Then, quote, of a sudden he stopped and exclaimed, "Hold on, shall I do as I feel led?" Oh, I should tell you who's here. Prayer meeting with Joseph F. Smith and 4 apostles, Joseph, John Taylor, Wilford Woodruff, George A. Smith, George Q. Cannon. So here he's doing it in the presence of apostles, but not the most senior apostles. And his own first counselor, Heber C. Kimball, was not even present. So, of a sudden, Brigham Young stopped and exclaimed, "Hold on, shall I do as I feel led? I always feel well to do as the Spirit constrains me. It is my mind to ordain Brother Joseph F. Smith to the apostleship and to be one of my counselors." End quote. He then asked for the feelings of the apostles present, who gave the idea hearty approval. After which, Brother Joseph F. Smith knelt upon the altar, and we laid our hands upon him, Brother Brigham being mouth. Young then ordained Joseph F. Smith an apostle and a counselor to the First Presidency. And so the secrecy of this ordination is shown by the fact that a few days later, Heber C. Kimball came to Joseph F. Smith and told him he had had a spiritual witness that someday he would become an apostle. And Joseph F. Smith later said that he felt very embarrassed that he couldn't tell Kimball that he actually had been already ordained an apostle. And this story may be in the context of, there's kind of a tension between Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball. In 1867, we had a vacancy in the quorum. And so, again, we have an interesting background on what happened at this point. Brigham decided he wanted to put Brigham Young Jr. in that vacancy. And Brigham Young Jr. in his diary writes this, "Brother George A. Smith suggested that it might raise a question and comment if Brigham Young Jr. was put in the place of Brother A.M. Lyman, apostatized. And if Joseph F. Smith was now put into the quorum, it would make no difference, as I, Brigham Young Jr., was ordained an apostle and would take my place in the quorum according to that ordination." And again, that shows that seniority was by ordination. So, Joseph F. Smith was put into, joined the quorum before Brigham Young Jr. Okay, Brigham Young acceded to George Smith's council, and this is what happened. However, in the next vacancy in 1868, Brigham Young, Jr., was put into the quorum. And there's kind of a glitch. In the first conference, he was sustained after Joseph F. Smith, but that was corrected. The conference is after. Brigham Young, Jr. took his seniority by date of ordination, so he was sustained ahead of Joseph F. Smith. Okay, and I should just mention briefly, Orson Hyde, as you see in the 1867 listing there, Orson Hyde was president of the Quorum of the Twelve, Orson Pratt was next in seniority, and in, I believe it was 1875, I've got to check this, it's either 1875 or 1876, but Brigham Young, oh no, what happened was it was in a San Pete conference, and Brigham Young told Hyde and Pratt that because they had had problems in Nauvoo and had been taken from the quorum, that their seniority would be docked because of that. And so it was seniority by longest continuous presence in the quorum. So they took places behind John Taylor and Wilford Woodruff. Otherwise, Orson Hyde might have become president of the church. And again, it shows how Brigham Young was, he was, you know, he would make rules and people followed them. He was a very powerful figure, as we all know. Okay, so now I turn back to John Willard. What has he been doing all these years? Well, I told you a little bit about his business practices. One day he would be a millionaire, next day he would be penniless. He became chronically indebted and beset by creditors. He raised money with a golden tongue, but when his projects failed, the many contributors felt betrayed. Very controversial figure. And some people thoroughly disliked him and thought he was completely dishonest. And yet, Brigham Young, the father, had a real soft spot for John Willard Young. And John Willard loved to be in the East, loved to be wheeling and dealing, and Brigham Young kept trying to get him to come back to Utah to take his place, you know, as a general authority. And so it's a really fascinating study in a father-child relationship, father-son relationship. And a couple times, Brigham Young even said, okay, if you'll come back and take your place among general authorities, I'll help you with some of your debts. And he did this when he finally got him to come back and become first counselor in the first presidency. And this happened in October 1876. So John Willard had never been a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, but he became first counselor in the first presidency. And this is very not too far from Brigham Young's death. And you can see that he kind of wanted to introduce John Willard into the hierarchy and get, I believe, the other general authorities used to him. One very interesting behind-the-scenes vignette shows tensions between John Willard and Joseph F. Smith. After Brigham Young called John Willard his first counselor, Joseph F., quote, stated that he thought the people would very much prefer to see Brigham Jr. selected. So Joseph F. Smith was quite a strong-minded individual to say this to Brigham Young. Rather than to take John W. to fill that position. And again, it shows a lot of resistance from the other general authorities toward John Willard. President Young turned to John F. and, shaking his finger at him, said, I have got Brigham Jr., and I have got you, and I want John W. So he had a great partiality for this kind of wayward son. So then Brigham instructed Joseph F. to prepare for a five-year European mission. Right after that. I'm sure it was totally a coincidence. Joseph F. went to Europe, but Brigham died soon after, and the other general authorities called him back. So after Brigham Young's death, Joseph Willard was left without his, you know, closest protector. And as you can imagine, it's a history of conflict of him with the rest of the general authorities. Because it's kind of paradoxical. He's left as first counselor in the first presidency. It's almost the second highest position in the church. And yet he kind of had an ambiguous status because he'd never been a member of the Quorum of the Twelve. So what they did with him is they had him and Daniel H. Wells, who was the other counselor, who had never been in the Quorum of the Twelve. The Twelve called them as counselors to the Twelve. They did not bring them into the Quorum of the Twelve. And even though they still recognized their seniority by apostolic ordination. Okay, John Willard continued in his business practices back east. He continued having problems with his business practices. He was constantly called on the carpet by the other general authorities, and there's a whole line of times when they actually tried him, and he would never quite get disfellowshipped or excommunicated, but they were often extremely displeased with him. He figured in Utah's attempts for statehood. He knew a lot of people back east. He knew a lot of the political ropes, and Leo, I'm sure, would tell us more about this. And he was entrusted with extensive funds from the church to grease judicial, editorial, or political wheels. And there were accusations that all of this money didn't always get to, you know, the proper judicial, editorial, or political sources it was supposed to go to. He had a tradition of living in a very high style. John Willard did. Okay. In 1891, he was having one of his periodic problems with the general authorities, and he sent in his letter of resignation as counselor to the Twelve. Okay, so he still was an apostle. He still had his seniority by the apostleship, but he was not an acting general authority at that time, from 1891 on. His tragedy of his life continued to spiral downward. Four of his five wives left him. Financial disaster forced him to leave for Europe. Many projects failed. He left many of his laborers unpaid. It's just the story of his life. Okay, Woodruff succeeded John Taylor as church president, and then Snow succeeded Woodruff in 1898. And John Willard's seniority is creeping up to where it's dangerous. And Brigham Young Jr., who had witnessed that ordination, was a member of the Quorum of the Twelve. And of course, Brigham Young Jr.'s seniority was creeping up also. And on December 9th, 1899, Franklin D. Richards died. He was the president of the Quorum of the Twelve, which left John Willard Young technically president of the Quorum of the Twelve. His president of the church, Lionel Snow, was sick, very old. So we have kind of a real succession crisis looming here, even though John Willard had never technically, you know, been a member of the Quorum of the Twelve.
Where was he at that point? Was he back east?
Yeah, he had a tendency to be back east. Sometimes he visited Utah.
He was after who, Lorenzo Snow?
Some of the time he was in Europe to escape the creditors,
yes,
back east.
After Lorenzo Snow.
Yeah. Okay, so by the accepted system in use, he was the person who should succeed Lorenzo Snow at that time. However, no one wanted him as the next president. In fact, some authorities felt that his succession would be a disaster for the church, which I think it would have been. But Brigham Young's desire for his favorite son to gain the presidency, sealed by an ordination half a century earlier, was still a shadow falling across the hierarchy. Even if his accession faced practical challenges, which it did, his legal status still would produce uncertainty and ambiguity in the next succession. So the final chapter in the story of John Willard and his succession took place. It would also affect his brother Brigham Young, Brigham Jr. So after Woodruff's death on September 2nd, 1898, his counselors, George Q. Cannon, Joseph F. Smith, briefly returned to their function as member of the Twelve, and Smith sat below Brigham Young Jr. However, after the meeting, a junior member of the quorum, Heber J. Grant, objected to Smith being behind Young. And I've just been reading the diaries of Heber J. Grant, who was a relative of mine, kind of a uncle, in my family, and he had no qualms about going up against some of the older members of the quorum when he was a young member of the quorum. So he objected to this, and Brigham Young replied that he said, I asked my father about it one time, and my father said, that's the right way, don't you change it, you're ahead of Joseph F. Smith. And he said, I'm fit to be an apostle, I haven't done anything wrong. And, you know, John Willard Young had never been excommunicated, he'd never been disfellowshipped even. However, the question was up, and Lorenzo Snow and other leading members of the church started talking about it among themselves. And Brigham Young Jr. also said, whatever you decide is okay, I yield my views to yours with all my heart. And he was very humble about it. So, 1900, Snow, Cannon, Joseph F. Smith, the first presidency, had a private discussion about the policy of seniority by date of ordination. And Snow told Smith that Brigham Young Jr. ranked below him in seniority. Okay, so that's a change. It's just simply a change. So on April 5th, 1900, at a meeting of the First Presidency in the Council of the Twelve, the subject was discussed at length, and we have some diaries that reflect what was said. And how am I doing for time? About done?
Good.
Really?
Okay. It's exactly four, but you didn't... You
could
take another 5 minutes, please.
Okay. John Henry Smith spoke. He said, he regarded this as a very important question from the fact that he understood there had been quite a number of men ordained apostles who had never been voted upon as such by the church. And I think he's definitely referring to, well, Brother Smith said he recognized the right of the president of the church to ordain his sons apostles if he chose to exercise that right, and he took it for granted that the late President Young ordained Brigham and others of his brother's apostles, and he supposed history was correct in stating that Brigham and John W. were ordained before President Cannon. So they definitely knew about the ordination of John W., and it was a problem. And on this phase of the proposition, the question of man was simply this: has a father, himself being an apostle, a right to ordain his son to the apostleship, and that son to preside without the action of the church, his ordination antedating that of the man chosen and ordained by the church? The speaker said to his mind there was but one view to be taken to safeguard the church and this council and to the maintenance of their dignity in the world. Such ordinations were dependent on joint action, first on the presentation by the First Presidency to the Council of the Twelve Apostles for their acceptance, and then to the people for their approval. And then he must be ordained in the proper way. Otherwise, it would open a door for questions to be sprung entirely unlooked for. So, you know, I think that's a very sensible position, but it's totally opposite of what Brigham Young had said and had done. They talked about it, and to finish up, President Snow, quote, expressed his love and admiration for Joseph Brigham Young Jr., and then asked the council to sustain the decision that Smith outranked Elder Young, Elder Brigham Young Jr. The vote was unanimous. And so the policy was changed. So in this momentous but little-known change of policy, Joseph F. Smith and Brigham Young Jr. traded places once again. George Q. Cannon was still alive and would have preceded them into the presidency, but Cannon died on April 12, 1901, before Snow. So now John Willard had no apostolic seniority at all, though perhaps he didn't know about it. On October 10, 1901, Lorenzo Snow died. 5 days later, John Willard was in Utah. And Watson, who wrote a thesis on Willard, writes, it was entirely possible that it was for succession reasons that John W. arrived in Salt Lake City. If so, he must have been bitterly disappointed when he discovered the policy change. His rival and critic, Joseph F. Smith, became president of the church on October 17, 1901, nominated by Brigham Jr. and set apart by Joseph F.'s brother, Patriarch John Smith. And at this time, he said, there should be no delays anymore in creating the First Presidency. Previous to this, there had all been delays in creating the First Presidency. So this system that we take so much for granted in our modern church did not reach its present state until our century. It was not developed fully in the 19th century. So John Willard returned to New York, which he probably felt closer to than Utah. And in his final years, he served as an elevator operator in an exclusive New York hotel, where he had once been a high-paying resident. And this change in his life is one of the haunting stories in Mormon history. And he would attend the New York branch as a regular member, but the branch president left a record that he would have to corner new members and warn them not to lend any money to John Willard when he approached them. So he continued with that pattern, you know, even when he was hardly anyone in New York. He just continually tried to borrow money from people. There was a horrifying murder case where his son was involved in a murder, which further, you know, made his life miserable. He died of cancer on February 24, 1924, and he died without a friend in the world, wrote the local general authority. So despite John Willard's charisma, his dreams, his desire to benefit his people and church through financial projects, as he expressed it, he remains a profoundly tragic figure, if one of the most interesting in LDS church history. He was the favorite son of the most powerful figure in Utah Mormonism. He was ordained and groomed for the presidency. From 1901, he was senior apostle of the church by date of ordination. By another set of circumstances, he might have directed the church for 23 years, which is a sobering thought. Yet because of this questionable business practice, his questionable business practices, his love of the cities of the East Coast, and without his father as advocate, he lost the protection of both church and family, living as an entirely obscure figure for many years before his death. And I ended my paper by looking at some of the important themes in his life, but I thought it might be interesting to, after Leo talks, open it up to the group and see what strikes you about his life, and then maybe I'll tell you a little bit about what I wrote there.
I watched his dad play ball at BYU. His name was LeGrand, Steve's dad. Todd did a great job. That's a great paper. He wrote it 10 years ago.
The first draft. When these sources were not available very much, and when very few people dared say anything against Brigham Young. And I hope he'll publish it. And I volunteer to help with some of the other brethren's insights and prejudices against John W. It's outrageous that a dad would do that to me. Now, maybe he was inspired, but circumventing the process through which the Lord chooses a prophet, just think about that for a little bit. And it's not that it wasn't known. I just gave him an editorial in the, had just been founded a year before as the Anti-Mormon Tribune. Salt Lake Tribune was the Anti-Mormon Tribune at the beginning, and they were tough on Brigham, but nobody that's ever written church history has paid much attention to that, and so we don't know the feelings that were being expressed against Brigham, but the title of that editorial in the Tribune was about this young dynasty, and they were talking about Brigham Jr. as well as John Willard. The book that's just out in the other room, edited by Sillitoe and Staker, has a chapter I did on Moses Thatcher, and there's a presidency crisis in that, if you never saw it in the dialogue article. But the guy that was campaigning against Wilford Woodruff was Heber J. Grant. And Todd called him a kind of challenger of the status quo sometimes. He knew that Joseph F. Smith was going to be the prophet someday. It was in his patriarchal blessing. And he tried to talk Wilford Woodruff into deferring and not even being the president of the church. Let Joseph F. go right to it. I think Wilford Woodruff remembered the charge that he had gotten from Joseph Smith that the seniority was the way to go. But as Todd implied, there wasn't a set cut and dried process until it had been established through the rest of the 19th century. I don't have much to say about Todd's paper, except that I am grateful to have somebody else taking some shots at Brigham once in a while. Welcome to the club, Todd. I do have some insights into John W. He had been in the East a lot, I think partly because he can portray himself as the heir to the throne back there. The people in Utah and Arizona know him too well. Todd has drawn very heavily on a couple of Utah Historical Quarterly articles and a doctoral dissertation by a guy named Watson, who was a community college teacher in southern Arizona, Thatcher, Charles Watson, whom I helped write his dissertation a little bit. And he had a great opportunity to document how much the people of Arizona disliked John W. Young, because John had been a contractor of railroad grades for railroads being built across northern Arizona, and hardly any of those people were ever paid, even if John W. was paid. And there were times when he actually, in the 1880s and 90s, was not listed to be sustained as a general authority, and the brethren had decided the reason they wouldn't list his name was that he hadn't paid those debts. Todd mentioned that letter of resignation. That came after a time when he was omitted from the list of people sustained in conference. None of those books that talk about building railroads for the kingdom, or articles, including a good friend of mine, Guy Bishop, as a rookie, they play him up bigger than he really was. He was Brigham Young's son, and he can play on that influence, both in getting contracts from the railroad and in getting money from lenders. But I defy Todd or anybody else to find that much that he does in railroad building. He is a slick talker. He's a most impressive figure. But don't play up too high his contribution as a railroad builder. You can talk about him as a great talker, but that's about as far as it goes. Now, as far as a lobbyist for the church, he's already had some of these problems with the brethren before. In 1886, he works out an arrangement with President Grover Cleveland and three members of his cabinet and several other key Democrats to try and help Utah get statehood. And the first presidency is a committee on statehood, and they work with him. They try to work with him. Again, and I spent a lot of a chapter in Political Deliverance on John W. Young. He's all talk. There really isn't any substance in the accomplishments he makes in helping Utah get statehood. Statehood comes in spite of him. And one of the people who realizes that first is Joseph F. Smith, who gets back there and sees this man living in luxury while the church leaders in Utah are in hiding and the church is in debt. Now, Todd's paper makes it very clear that Joseph F. has stood up to John W. before. But there are other apostles, including Heber J. Grant, whom Todd quoted in the paper, that are wise to this guy who I would say is phony as a $3 bill, John Willard Young, who might have been the prophet of this church. And his dad seemed to be condoning such a thing. It's a sad story, but it's scary too, and it needs to be told. I'll help you document a little more what the other brethren think of John. It's interesting how much is in that CD-ROM, out of probably Quinn's notes, I suspect, but we'll never know all of that.
Is it bad as Enron?
For the church, some of Brigham's things rank higher than the biographers of Brigham ever said. No. That's all I wanted to say. Good job, Todd. Thank you.
No offense, I know you.
I'd be interested in some thoughts on the story, and then I'll tell you a little bit about some of my conclusions, but I think I was the first hand over there. Do you want to talk in the mic? It's up to you. Okay.
You said he had five wives and four of them left him. Which one stayed with him? And how many children did he have, and what happened to the children?
Repeat the question.
Okay. He asked about John Willard's family, his five wives, and which left him and which stayed with him, how many children he had, and this is totally inexcusable for me, who wrote a whole other book on the wives of one of the general authorities, but I did not do research into that at all. It wasn't part of that particular story, except to say that a lot of them left him. So, I have to plead ignorance.
As I remember Todd's paper, four divorced him. The other separated. He doesn't have any wives with him. In fact, he apparently had an affair with an actress who was not in the church in the East. And you knew about that.
It's in one of my footnotes. But again, I'm not sure how well that can be documented, but there were rumors of that kind of thing happening. But yeah, it also says in one of my footnotes, one of the children said, "I've never known a father." And so that's typical of, that often happens with polygamy, but I think in his case, he was just never interested. He was interested in raising money and so on. And that's the impression I get of John Willard. Lynn?
Currently, is it the order of affairs that when an apostle is called, that he is sustained before by the church before he is ordained, or do they ordain him and then sustain him in conference?
Okay, the question is, now, do they ordain an apostle first, or do they sustain him first in conference? And again, you've caught me off guard. I don't know. I would assume that they ordain him first, and then, but someone in the back thinks that they sustain him first and then ordained. But that's a very good question. I'll have to look into that. Again, what are some of the broad issues, you think, that we're seeing here in this whole story? I think this hand was first, and then maybe Steve.
Mine are still questions. I'm sorry. I wish I had an insight. But two quick questions. So now the policy is, when you're sustained, is the age from when you're sustained as a member of the quorum?
Yes. The question is, since seniority is it by when you enter the quorum, and that's true. So you're ordained at the same time, but you enter the quorum at the same time.
Albert Dyer and some others were made apostles, but they never, or counselors, but they never.
Right, and they were one of these situations where they never entered the 12.
So
but
they would never be in the hierarchy.
So they had no seniority and as far as apostolic succession, right.
And Brigham Young Jr., who was not at, he was behind Joseph F. Smith because of the quorum. Is that correct?
Yes, Joseph F. Smith, Joseph Young Jr. Was ordained before Joseph Smith. However, he entered the Quorum of the Twelve after Joseph F. Smith.
But it sounds like he was somewhat of a humble and whatever you want to do. Yes. Was he a good guy?
Yes.
What did he think
yes.
of his brother?
Yes. I think he had, he refers to him in his letters to Brigham Young, and he says, "I have lots of sympathy for my brother. He's being dunned by creditors all the time." And but Brigham Young Jr. was seen as quite non-charismatic, but quite humble. But, John Willard was more charismatic.
Probably not totally respected by his brethren, except as a humble, hard-working, good man. They called him Briggy. They didn't want him to be the head of the church. But he was a good guy.
Before Joseph F. Smith died?
No.
Brigham Young Jr., I mean.
No.
No. But
they switched seniority, so Joseph Smith became president of the church instead of Brigham Young. Because
by the time he died at Heber J. Grant, he was dead. Brigham Young Jr. was dead.
Yeah.
Got it. Sorry.
Yes.
I wonder if Brigham Young didn't feel justified after Joseph Smith ordained his son.
Okay, the question is, Brigham Young feel justified in ordaining his sons secretly because Joseph Smith had evidently given a blessing to his son? And this, we're kind of getting close to one pattern that I think is really important here, and that is the tendency for 19th century church leaders to bring their sons into the hierarchy at a very young age, which gave them a great chance of becoming president of the church. And I find that it's a very interesting contrast with the modern hierarchy, because we do not see Gordon B. Hinckley ordaining his son when he's 23 years old to become
an
apostle.
Woodruff and Taylor and Cannon all did.
Yes.
Yeah. And Todd will mention that in his paper, I'm sure, that Woodruff, Taylor, and Cannon did ordain sons. And there was that favoritism. But it stopped, and it's fortunate that it has.
Yeah, and they ordained them at a very, brought them into the quorum at a very young age. So it's kind of interesting. It's kind of like then it was expected. Now it's almost like there's a rule against it. And I think that's a good change in our church's policy.
My hero is Abraham Cannon. He was ordained an apostle at 37. He'd have been a prophet if he'd lived a normal life, age-wise.
Joseph Fielding Smith was called.
He's one of those.
Yeah.
He had a brother that was there before him.
Yeah, Joseph F. Smith. I ended my story with him becoming prophet, but one of the first things he did was bring one of his sons into the apostleship. And that son didn't become president, but he brought another son in, Joseph Fielding Smith, who did, you know, become a prophet in our generation.
Well, and then Joseph Fielding Smith brought his son-in-law in.
Yeah. Okay, but that wasn't his son.
The end of patriarch? Do you see a tie with the end of patriarch? And, you know, we don't have...
The question is there a tie with patriarch and...
We don't have fathers.
Well, the whole system of calling people as church leaders because of their, you know, relationship with leaders, I think it's tied with that, you know, the lineal succession of patriarchs. That, again, our church has downgraded, and there's the wonderful book by Smith and Irene Bates on, you know, the slow departure of the patriarch position in our church. Steve?
I see the theme that they really did do this, because I see it not only all the things that you've mentioned, but when Joseph Smith III came out to Utah, Brigham told him, if you'll come, you will be president of this church. He says, you'll fulfill the prophecy, but it'll be your choice. And he chose not to.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they were trying to, you know, get... This is like David. This was David and his son. This was still in an era when you had kings and there had kingdoms. And they were still thinking of kingdoms
mm-hmm.
at this point.
That's why this editorial is called the dynasty. The guy mm-hmm. in the back said his head.
Yeah. Hold on. I just want to respond to that. There was a very good comment by my old roommate, Steve Nelson, saying that there was kind of this idea of kingship, and you had a dynasty, and he mentioned Joseph III coming to Utah, and Brigham Young saying, well, if you accept, you know, our church, well, you will become president of the church, and which of course never happened. But the whole, you know, Community of Christ, RLDS Church, was based on the whole idea of lineal succession. So it was very important in the 19th century church, not just in the RLDS church, but you can see in the story of Brigham Young, you know, in our church also. And, you know, Wilford Woodruff, John Taylor, all called young sons to be in the apostleship. But in our generation, in our church, it's changed. And I think that's a good, healthy change. It's almost like there's a rule against this kind of calling your sons at a young age into the apostleship. Okay, Orel?
I believe you mentioned that Brigham Young ordained four sons. What happened to the other two?
Okay, question was, Brigham Young ordained four sons. What happened to the other two? And once again, you've caught me in an area where I didn't do a lot of research, but they didn't, you know, they didn't have much to do with the hierarchy. I know that. One is very obscure, Brigham Heber. We barely know that he was ordained an apostle, and I don't know much more about it. I didn't look into him. And the other was his oldest, Joseph Angel, and I suspect that
He died young.
He died, okay.
Do you know about the other one, Newell?
Not that much, really, just from what I was able to parse from book, the letters, Dean Jesse.
Yeah, letters to his sons.
Yeah, from what I parsed from there, that's about all I know.
Some of them have very short lives.
Yeah.
pleads ignorance after many years after writing his book.
20 years ago. But I see, you know, I just want to make a comment if I could. I was going to say that when I wrote that book, I have to confess, and Leo caught me on this and has made comments, but I had a much more favorable attitude toward Brigham Young, because I was actually coming after, do you want me to, I can just briefly tell you.
When I completed my biography back in 1986 when the biography was published, and actually when I sat down to write the biography, I really approached Brigham Young from a very negative perspective, because I'd done my book on Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, and in that earlier study he came across as sort of the villain, because he was the formulator of the priesthood restriction policy. So I had a very, very negative attitude toward Brigham Young. But as I got going through the various letters and various other materials and looking at the complexity of his life, I ended up writing, I became more empathetic. I guess this way, biographers tend to be very empathetic toward their topics. And so when that was published in 86, I know Leo was, looks at Brigham Young quite differently, particularly from, some of his relatives. from what happened to Amasa Lyman and some other unpleasant incidents. In retrospect, now after 20 years, the book has been in print for, I guess, 15, going on 20 years now. I'm almost in a little bit of agreement with Leo that perhaps I was too easy on Brigham Young on certain areas. I mean, there's a new study that's coming out. I mean, there's all kinds of revisionism, kind of counter-revisionism that's being done on Brigham Young right now. Just this new book that's forthcoming from Will Bagley, the role of Brigham Young in the Mountain Meadow Massacre, probably the most explosive and the most controversial incident in Mormon history. And so there's kind of this counter... So it sort of goes in cycles. And if I were to do the Little Brown biography again, I'd probably be more in agreement with Leo, with the assessment. I don't think it goes quite as far as Will Bagley, though. But anyway, that's just my comment.
Mark. Your hand was up.
Recently the Community of Christ have also given up a dynastic succession with the appointment of Ramping Murray. Do you see any similarities there? And
Mark Edlund has mentioned that the Community of Christ /RLDS Church has given up lineal succession with the accession of Grant McMurray. And do I see any parallels? And yes, I do, and it's kind of interesting. They stayed extremely conservative on that one issue for a long time, and finally changed. And we, and I think that change in our policy, it must have happened behind the scenes in the 20s or 30s or something like that, and we don't know much about it. But you can see it's like night and day, the difference, in... church leaders calling their sons to be apostles. By the way, one of my main points in my conclusion that's related to all this was the church can change. And that's one of the themes I see in this story, is that the church changed over the year on a very important issue. And you might say that it takes a crisis to get them to do it, but they did change, and I think the final, what they came up with was a lot better than the way it was in the beginning with Brigham Young, because Brigham Young's system gave the president a lot of power if he could secretly ordain people. And the way it finally ended up, it's a more democratic system, and so the church can change. It can change for the better. If there's any... censors listening outside on the tape or something like that. I ended this on a positive note, okay? And I didn't write this to bash Brigham Young. I'm fascinated, though, by his weakness for John Willard. And you can see that this very human weakness could have had a very powerful impact on how the church went.
Leo,
later years.
How do you see that weakness? The fact that he had sort of handpicked John Willard, do you think he there was a blind spot there on Brigham's part, that he would select
such an eminently flawed individual.
Well, there's only 11.
He had made the choice already, but I think that most dads are pretty blind to the... he criticized his son for living so lavishly in the East off of church money. Even Brigham did, but he did cover for him, and it would be impossible to know if he's paying those debts with church money or Brigham's money, because they're so closely mixed. Just one more point on the dynastic aspect. That editorial that I gave Todd mentions Oliver Cromwell and Richard Cromwell, who did not succeed him. And that's an interesting parallel.
Let me ask this guy, Mark. Yes?
Yeah, I guess it was 1905, around there, the Reed Smoot hearings. Joseph S. Smith, when testifying there, was asked about a rule of succession in the church, and he said there was no rule. There was a custom, but no rule. Uh-huh. I assume that you were aware of that. I just want to get any comments on that in the context of what you're talking about.
Yeah, the remark was Joseph F. Smith was asked in 1905, I assume in the Smoot hearings, right, about whether there was a rule of succession in the church, and he said there was no rule. And I think that's technically correct. There was no ironclad rule, and even now it's possible for, you know, the Quorum of the Twelve to say we're going to pick, you know, someone totally out of left field to become president of the church. However, it became such a custom that it would take a really strange situation to depart from that custom. It's, you know, one of the most important and fast and hard customs in our church. So it's almost to the point of being a rule, but technically, it's not a hard and fast rule. In our generation, Joseph F. Smith, Joseph Fielding Smith, was very aged and weak. And you can read this in Mike Quinn's book, who talks a lot about some of these conflicts between the Quorum of the Twelve and the President of the Church. But there was a big possibility he would not become President of the Church because of he was so elderly and weak. And he according to how Mike tells the story, he kind of went to some of the senior members of the Quorum and said, look, just let me be president and I won't do anything. And so he became president.
We're at the end of the hour. Let's thank our two presenters.